Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome. My name is Joe. I'm an associate minister here at Real Life. It's my pleasure to be with you. If you've joined us online, welcome. We're glad to have you here with us as we continue on our journey to Easter. Now, we started out on this conversation a few weeks back where we talked about Jesus's entry into Jerusalem, which would have been Palm Sunday, which is what the day is today really about as we celebrate Jesus's triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Last week, we talked about Jesus in the garden, I guess, and what he went through in his prayer time and wrestling with God about what he was about to step into. And this morning, we arrive at Golgotha. Now, I do want to preface our conversation with a few things. One, there is a lot of content this morning, and you're going, as on par with Joe, we're going to be talking. We're going to be learning this morning, and so hopefully you grab notes. We have notes that we provide, and this will help you move through our conversation today and help you hold on to the information we're going to be throwing out there, because we will be throwing out a lot of information. Secondly, I just need to let you know that the conversation this morning is going to be heavy. It's going to be heavy, because we're going to be talking about the cross. And if this conversation that involves a conversation about death, torture, suffering, is maybe triggering, or maybe you have young kids that maybe you're just like, I'm not sure they need to hear about this in this capacity. Don't worry, I'm not showing any Passion of the Christ clips, okay? But it's not also going to be G-rated either. Because you can't when you're talking about the significance of the cross. And so we do have our check-in in Life for Kids. If you wanted to take your kids in there, they'd love to love on your kids during this time if you feel like you'd like to do that. That is my forewarning. You ready to get into this? All right, here we go. We're going to start out today in Jerusalem. Jerusalem, this is a picture of the city of Jerusalem that would have been during the time of Jesus, most likely. This is a depiction of it. We're going to start off talking about a little bit about where Jesus went and what he did. I encouraged people that might have seen it on Facebook to read chapters 18 and 19 out of John's gospel before coming to church, because that's where we're going to be staying today, is in John chapter 18 and 19. So maybe if you saw that video clip, I encourage you to, hopefully you watched it and did it. If you didn't, don't worry, it'll be there when you get home, and you can read chapter 18 and 19 together as a family or on your own, however you wish, and it might fill in some of the gaps, because I'm not going to read line for line the two chapters. We're going to stay kind of high level this morning as we move through this. So for your reference, everything we talk about is John chapter 18 and 19. But we're going to start out in Jerusalem, and I'm going to locate some places on the map. And I just need you to know that this is a general scholarship consensus on where things took place. We don't know exactly where everything happened when Jesus was spending his last week there. We know some areas. So just know that it's not perfect. If you learn something else, like, oh, I thought it was more over here, that's okay. It doesn't matter. It'll all make sense when we come to the point of why we're going through this. So just clarify there. First off, we need to understand Jesus spent his Last Supper, his what we call the Last Supper, the Passover. This would have been a dinner that they would have shared since they were little babies. Every year they do this. Jesus, in the Last Supper that we have in the Gospels, does it a little bit different, and he spends his Last Supper up in this region, the upper city of Jerusalem. When he's done with dinner, the evening has arrived, and they decide to go on a walk to the Garden of Gethsemane. This walk would have been outside the Kidron Valley. This would have been roughly the location. We actually have good evidence for the location of Gethsemane. Justin talked about this last week. We know of the olive press that sits in the Kidron Valley. Most likely would have been the place that Jesus would have taken them. But this route, whether he went through the city, I don't know if he went through the city or he went around the city. That's just where I laid it out there, because we don't know. But roughly, either route that you go, that's about a 5-minute walk. So when you think of like the city, don't think of Boise City, where it's like he went from Eagle Road to like the North End, okay, for a walk. This is about a 5-minute walk. This isn't a large city. It was in the ancient world, a very large city, but in our modern context, it's not a large city. And so it wouldn't have taken them long to get to the garden, but they walk to the garden. Jesus experiences this traumatic experience where he is praying deeply and intentionally and wrestling with the Father about what he's about to go through. That prayer time is done. The disciples wake up. He wakes them up because a bunch of soldiers come into the garden to arrest him, led by one of his own, Judas. And so they arrest him. This would have not have been Roman soldiers. This would have been the Sanhedrin soldiers. These were religious leaders that were coming to arrest him. And so they come to him in the garden, they arrest Jesus, and they immediately take him to Annas and Caiaphas. These were religious high-ups. Annas was the high priest, and this most likely would have been the location that Annas and Caiaphas would have been at. Again, this is at night. Okay, so they're not at work near the temple. They would have been in their homes, most likely, okay? And so they take him there. Annas has a conversation with, this is the father-in-law to Caiaphas, has a conversation with Jesus, sends him over to Caiaphas. Caiaphas interviews Jesus and through that conversation determines that Jesus needs to die. They need to kill him because of the things that he's saying. But the problem is that the religious leaders don't have the authority to kill anybody. So they got to take him over to Pilate to talk to them, the Roman Empire, the Roman leaders, to execute Jesus. So they leave that place and they go visit Pilate. Now, on the map here, I have two dots. This represents Pilate and Herod, both characters who were involved in this story. I have them here because this is where Herod's palace would have been. Now, we need to know Pilate didn't live in Jerusalem. He had a house on the coastal city Caesarea. He would have come into Jerusalem, visiting Jerusalem during this festival. And because he didn't have a home there, he would have most likely stayed in Herod's palace as a guest of Herod. Okay, Herod had jurisdiction of this area. Pilate didn't live there. So he most likely came in for the festival, would have been staying either near Herod's palace or maybe a room in Herod's palace as a guest of Herod during this time. So most likely they would have been close to each other. So they go to Pilate. Pilate is basically like, I don't know why you're bringing this to me. This is my business. Herod has jurisdiction here. Take it to him. I don't care. So they go over to Herod, which might have been like across the street or like, you know, just down the other end of the palace. They wake him up and he comes out and he's still kind of partying it up. It's been a long night. And he finally goes, you know what? I don't have anything to do with this either. Send him back to Pilate. They go back to Pilate. And then the whole encounter is happening in front of Pilate. Now, sometimes in our imagination, we picture hundreds of people standing in like this open, huge crowd of people around. This wouldn't have been the case. It would have been a small group of the religious leaders. Why? Because it's in the middle of the night. And that's important. We'll get to that in a minute. So it just would have been a handful of religious leaders that are trying to get Jesus killed. So they have a conversation with Pilate. Pilate interviews Jesus, goes back out to the religious leaders. He's having conversations with them. They're wanting him dead. He's like, I don't get it, but whatever. We'll go ahead and do it. So he hands Jesus over to be killed. So there's some back and forth that's taken place. I have this dot up here because if by chance Pilate was somewhere else, he would have been north of the temple, which would have been in this region here. But after they have some back and forth with Herod, Pilate says, okay, let's send him out to be killed. He's then walked out the city to the place of the skull called Golgotha to be crucified. Now, why do I tell you all of this information? Why is this important? There's a lot happening under the surface that just reading it, you know, on our own, we might miss. Here's a couple things to know. When Jesus was arrested, it would have been around 10, 11 midnight, right at the end of the night is when he would have been arrested, most likely. So again, there's no exact science here. They didn't say at this exact time. So roughly, generally speaking, it might have been in these hours that Jesus was arrested in the garden. Then he is goes through this whole experience, and then he's led out to be crucified. At the time that he was sentenced to die by crucifixion, it would have been around 8 or 9 in the morning. All of this takes place in, generally speaking, 8 to 10 hours. 8 to 10 hours. So the question that we need to wrestle with, I think we should wrestle with, is how do we get from celebrating Jesus' arrival and everybody so excited about him coming to then waking up in the morning and going, wait, he's dead? They're crucifying him? What happened? Can you imagine being one of those that was celebrating Jesus coming in? And you go to your Passover and you're like, man, this is great. And you go to bed and you wake up and they go, did you hear? And you go, hear what? They're killing Jesus right now. What? Wait, they're killing him? How did we get there? What is happening? And to understand that, we actually got to go back about 150 years. Because in the hearts and imaginations of the people that lived during this time was an event that took place roughly 150 years earlier, and it was called the Maccabean Revolt. You see, at this time in the Jewish history, the Greeks occupied Jerusalem, and they had set up in the temple worship to Zeus. And this completely made everyone lose their minds and said, we're not going to have this. So they started a revolt against the Greeks, led by the Maccabean family, Simon Maccabee. And Simon Maccabee, we're told that he leads an army in, and they actually kick out the Greeks, and they free the occupation so that they can have once again ownership of Jerusalem and the temple. And for the first time, since King David, a new dynasty is established in Jerusalem, where they actually own and occupy the temple for themselves. And so what happens is that in 1 Maccabees, which is an intertestamental book written about Jewish histories, in 1 Maccabees 15, we're told about the event that when they come into the temple and they're celebrating the fact that they had just freed themselves from the occupation and they had eradicated this foreign worship, we're told that as Simon Maccabee comes into the city, everyone grabs palm branches, waves them in the air, and begins to sing praises. Hosanna, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And so when we read about the triumphal entry, it's a little weird to think, like, wait a minute, all these people just randomly knew to grab palm branches and randomly knew to sing the same song? Is this like High School Musical? Like, what's going on? How did they all know this? How did they all know what to do? Because when Jesus was ministering, he talked about a kingdom. He talked about a new kingdom that was coming. And then he's doing these amazing powers, and he's healing people and raising people from the dead, and everyone's hearing this, and he's amassing a great following, and everyone's thinking, it's happening. It's happening, guys. It's happening. And Jesus comes in on a colt, and everyone goes, this is the moment. Here we go. Here we go. We're going to be free again. So the tension in the city would have been at an all-time high, everyone waiting for Jesus to do his thing. And he kind of showcases it a little bit. We're told on Monday or Tuesday, whatever the day was after he goes into the temple to teach, and he's flipping over tables, and he's causing commotion, and everyone's going, yeah, here we go. Here we go. Is it now? Is it now? Is it now? So why do they do this at night? Because if they would have done it during the day, everyone would have lost their minds and fought for Jesus. So they had to do it at night. It was the only way they could have gotten away with it and gotten rid of him. So they spend the night getting Jesus killed. We have powers at play under the surface of this story. There are three powers that are at play in this story. The first one is going to be the religious leaders. The religious leadership is trying to control and keep their power. They're trying to govern for themselves how they want everybody to live and be. And no matter how good intentions that they thought they had, they were trying to control their own power within this system. There was another power at play. This was the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, they had power that they were trying to keep. So they're trying to it's proxy Romano. It's the declaration that the Roman Empire has brought peace to the world. And so they're trying to keep the peace. And Pilate's like, I don't need Caesar getting mad at me because there's a big riot in the city. So I guess we're going to go ahead and kill him. So they have power they're trying to control. And there's a third power that's under the surface and it's not spoken about, but it most definitely was there. This was a spiritual power at play that was at work. Paul calls this the powers of darkness in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, not verse 3, if you're taking notes. A little typo there. It was in verse 12. He talks about that there are powers that exist under the surface. You don't necessarily see them. You see the outworking of those powers. right? And they're at work trying to keep their power. There was power, a big power struggle, and the whole time of this power struggle that's happening under the surface, Jesus is operating on a whole other level. Like he, it's like he's the only one in the room that knows what's actually going on. So he's remaining silent during the trial. He's not saying anything. And when he does say something, it's like a dagger to the heart. Dagger to the heart. So Jesus is the only one that knows what's going on. In fact, when addressing the subject of real power, Jesus makes this statement. It's actually in John chapter 18, verse 36. Jesus is talking to Pilate. And he says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest." What is Jesus talking about? When he says, "My kingdom's not of this world," we shouldn't be thinking of like an otherworldly heaven, like my place is over here, so this doesn't matter. He's not. He's doing a comparison of how you actually take power. He says, if my kingdom, essentially saying, if my kingdom was like your kingdom, Pilate, my people would already be fighting for my release. And they would have if they had known this was happening. I mean, we know in the garden, Peter was already ready to fight. All four Gospels talk about Peter taking out a sword when Jesus arrested and whacking off the ear of a guard. And what does Jesus do? He's operating on a whole other level. He goes, no, Peter, put your sword away. This is not how my kingdom works. The powers of this world take things by force. And Jesus says, that's not how mine is going to work. He's doing something completely subversive to everything around him. Jesus begins this kind of talk actually later in his ministry, but earlier in the story of the Gospels. All four Gospels record this statement from Jesus. In Matthew chapter 16, it reads like this. "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me.'" And we read that so passively sometimes because we're too familiar with the cross. We're actually too comfortable with the cross. We have it on display everywhere. We wear it around our necks. The cross is something that's been dulled in our imagination. But for Jesus to use a Jewish rabbi to use a Roman method of execution as a comparison of what it means to follow him would have been abhorrent for anyone to hear. This would have been disgusting because we don't understand what they went through. If we'd have put ourselves in the shoes of a first century Galilean, we would have grown up with death in front of our face every day. Most likely at some points walking from city to city, whatever Roman occupation existed there, we would have seen people hanging on crosses. We know of one account, Emperor Nero, this is after Jesus, Emperor Nero crucified so many people, and he would light them on fire, we learn. Tacitus tells us this. He lit them on fire so it would light the roads for people that are walking. In the ancient world, you grew up with death, and you grew up with the cross as something that was in your face, and it was the most brutal, ugly, disgusting form of execution that existed in the world. Never seen again. It was the most brutal way to die. The Romans didn't invent crucifixions, the Persians did, but all scholars agree that the Romans perfected it. They knew how to torture you and kill you. That's what they did. How do we know that this was such a deplorable, disgusting thing? Well, we have written sources like Cicero. Cicero is a Roman lawyer. He writes this: "Wretched is the loss of one's good name in the public courts. Wretched too, a monetary fine exacted from one's property, and wretched is exile. But still in each calamity, there is retained some trace of liberty. Even if death is set before us, we may die in freedom, but the executioner, the veiling of heads, and the very word cross, let them all be far removed from not only the bodies of Roman citizens, but even from their thoughts, their eyes, and their ears." In Roman high society, you wouldn't even mention the word cross. This is an honor and shame culture, and to be crucified was the most shameful thing that could take place. It was a dishonorable thing to be crucified. It was disgusting, and Cicero's telling us, like, we shouldn't even bring it up. We shouldn't see it. We shouldn't talk about it. It's that vile. We have Seneca. He says this, is there such a thing as a person who would actually prefer wasting in pain on a cross, dying limb by limb, one drop of blood at a time, rather than dying quickly? Would any human be willingly choose to be fastened to that cursed tree, especially after the beating that left him deathly weak, deformed, swelling with vicious welts on shoulders and chest, and struggling to draw every last agonizing breath? Anyone facing such a death would plead to die rather than mount the cross. In the ancient world, you didn't wear crosses around your neck. You didn't celebrate this. It was deplorable. We have Josephus, the Jewish author. He says this, every day Roman soldiers caught 500 Jews or more. The soldiers, driven by their hatred of the Jews, nailed them to the cross, to crosses. They nailed them in many different positions to entertain themselves and to horrify the Jews watching this spectacle from inside the walled city of Jerusalem. In time, the soldiers ran out of wood for crosses and room for crosses, even if they had found more wood. Josephus is telling us they crucified so many people, they ran out of wood. Most scholars say hundreds of thousands of people died at the hand of crucifixion. It was an ugly, brutal way to die. In crucifixions, it would happen like this. You would start off by being beaten. You would be flogged, you would with clubs, whips, many different methods. You would be tied up and you would just be beaten half to death. After you were beaten, you were then stripped naked. All these images of a clothed person on a cross would not have been historically accurate. You would have been stripped naked. Then you would be tied to a bar on your shoulders and you'd be forced to carry a portion of your cross through the crowds. You'd be publicly shamed, treated like an animal as you had to carry your cross naked after being beaten to the place of your eventual death. After you got to the location, you would have been nailed to that cross. And how you were nailed is that you would first be nailed through your wrists to the beam that you carried. Then you would have been lifted up to the position up high up on the cross. Then your feet would have been brought together and you would have been nailed at the feet. And you would be left there to hang and die. Scholarship tells us that people would die within 3 to 4 hours. And sometimes even 3 to 4 days, depending on how bad you, what shape you were in at the point of being lifted up on the cross. You would most likely die by suffocation. And how this worked is that as you were being hung on the cross, you're nailed in there, you're slumped down, all your body weight's by the wrists where you're nailed, and the only way that you could draw breath is if you had to push yourself up by the feet to draw some breath. Hold it as long as you could before you were weak and you gave out. You'd be beaten, had broken ribs, broken parts of your body. It would have been hard to breathe. So eventually you would suffocate and die. If you were taking too long to die, we know that your legs would have been broken. And why would they break their legs? Because then you couldn't push yourself up to draw any breath anymore. So you'd just be left there to die. After you died, you were taken off the cross and your body would most likely have been burnt or left for animals to eat. This was crucifixion. And the Romans were perfect at it. They knew exactly how to torture you. There are some writings that go almost too graphic. I had to pull a slide. But I don't know if I'm going to read that. But it talks about how Roman soldiers would take their spears and jab at people who were walking down the street getting crucified. It was a brutal, brutal act. And crucifixion served one point that was played out in three ways. Crucifixions were meant to humiliate you, dehumanize you, and then arrest. This is what crucifixions did. Let me explain. The first part, to humiliate and dehumanize you. Listen, it was deplorable to be crucified. Your family would have rejected you. If you were someone that were getting crucified, your family wouldn't be hanging out going, oh, we're so sad he's dying, let's get him off the cross. No, they would have left you. The worst of society got crucified. This wasn't something they just handed out willy-nilly. This was like the worst of the worst. People got crucified, and hundreds of thousands of people got crucified. So if you had a family member that got sentenced to death by crucifixion, you basically rejected them out of your family. Because in an honor-shame culture, you wouldn't want to be associated with someone that would have died at such a shameful death. And so this aspect was unthinkable for people to think that someone would worship someone that was crucified. But that's unthinkable in the ancient world. How do we know this? Well, we can look at the earliest picture of Jesus that we have in antiquity. This picture actually dates back to 115 AD. And what it depicts is a jail cell. There's a jail cell, and outside of the jail cell is a Roman prison. There must have been a Christian that was in prison there. And they have a guard that was outside watching this Christian, and the guard must have etched into the wall this picture. This picture is called the Alexamanos graffiti. We know nothing of Alexamanos except for this graffiti. And it was found outside a prison wall. And etched in the prison wall was this graphic. This is what it looks like transposed, so you can see it better. And what it depicts is a crucified man with a donkey head, a man standing next to him with arms lifted in worship. And at the bottom in the graffiti, it says this: Alexamanos worships his God. The earliest picture of Jesus in antiquity is him crucified with a donkey's head. Because it would have been ridiculous that you worshiped someone who was crucified. Like, unthinkable. You would have been made fun of. Wait a minute, your God was crucified? Only the worst in society get crucified. And thus, the Roman soldier, it was unthinkable for him to believe that Alexamanos would worship a crucified man, and to make fun of him, he depicts his God with a donkey head. Earliest picture of Jesus we have, right here, making fun of him. It's interesting when you read the Gospels and you come to someone like Paul. And Paul in Romans chapter 1 says something like this: I'm not ashamed of the gospel. And if we're reading with curious eyes, we should ask the question, why would you be ashamed, Paul? Like, I'm not ashamed. I can say Jesus. I'm not ashamed. Because in his world, it would have been shameful. Can you imagine going around trying to tell people to believe in Jesus? And they're like, okay, yeah, tell me about him. Well, he was crucified. Nah, I'm out. And Paul says, I'm not ashamed of that, guys. He even goes further in 1 Corinthians. He says, the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. What he's saying is that those who don't believe and have not put their trust in the grace and forgiveness and love of Christ, they look at the cross and they go, that's dumb that you would believe that. It's crazy to think about, because no one would have been crucified. It was a humiliating, dehumanizing act. But it wasn't simply that. Remember, it was also to erase you from history. It was to make it so as if you didn't even exist. We know of hundreds of thousands of peoples that have been crucified. The Josephus quote, 500 in a day were crucified. People, lots and lots and lots of people died of crucifixion. But here's the interesting thing. In antiquity, did you know that we only have 2 physical remains of anybody ever being crucified? There are only 2 physical remains in all of history that we have ever found of someone who has been crucified, and both were in the 20th century. The first one was found in 1948 in an ossuary box outside of Jerusalem. This depicts a heel bone, and you see the nail going through it. And at the end of the nail, it's bent in, which indicates most likely when this person was being crucified, it must have hit a knot in the wood maybe that bent the nail, and they couldn't have finished the job, so they most likely took him off the cross and just killed him. That was the first one ever found. The second one was found in 2017. And it was discovered with the skeletal remains. They were doing an excavation in a Roman colonized city. We don't know who it is. We know nothing about them. But the skeletal remain was found, which is not unusual when you're doing excavation, except for the fact they noticed something that had only been seen one other time in history: the heel bone. There was a nail going through it. There are only two physical remains in all of history of someone being crucified. What I'm about to say is not an overstatement. If Jesus had not resurrected from the grave, we never would have even known his name. If Jesus hadn't resurrected, we never would have heard of him. Because the point of crucifixion was to erase you from history. You were humiliated, treated like an animal, dehumanized, and then you were wiped off the face of the earth. Never to be remembered. Pre-Jesus, we have no record of a name of a person who has been crucified. We know of people that have been crucified post-Jesus. We know Jesus' name, and then they carried that forward with like the disciples and the way that they died through execution. We know their names. Do you know before Jesus, we don't even have any record name of someone because that was the point. You were to not be remembered. And yet Jesus resurrected. And we're all here today. So what's happening here? Jesus uses a Roman method of execution to kickstart something that he was doing that, like I said, he was operating on a whole other level. He knew exactly what he was doing. And here's the thing that I think we can glean from this. Of course, yes, absolutely, Jesus' death on the cross was an act to lead us out of sin. Okay? But Paul says that very clearly in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 1. He talks about this, that Christ died for our sins. Very clear. But there's something even deeper happening here. Something maybe even more profound to our daily actions of living. There's the moment of me asking God to forgive me, and that starts me on a journey of carrying my cross. What is Jesus doing here? What I believe that Jesus is doing is he's taking something that was meant to make you non-human and then to forget you for the rest of your life, to erase your life forever. He subversely comes along and says, I'm actually going to take that thing, and by the action of the cross, I'm actually going to show you how to be human and actually give you life. Jesus takes something that's meant to make you non-human, like an animal, and erase you from existence to be the very thing that actually gives you life and life more abundantly. Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. Follow me. Jesus is inviting us into this subversive kingdom that says, you think you want to save your life by controlling, like the religious leaders, like the Roman Empire, like the spiritual powers at play, that want to control by their own definition and decide what's good and not good and live according to your way. And Jesus says, not in my kingdom. If you actually want to find life, you have to lose it. This is what Jesus is inviting us into. The way of Jesus, which is to lay down your life for others, is the best way to be human and live an abundant life. If we're trying to be the kinds of people that are finding the best that God has for us, to live out the vocation that God has for us and the blessings that God has for us, we have to be people of the cross. There is no other way than to die to yourself, so that Christ can live fully and abundantly in you. Have you ever wondered when Jesus says things like, my burden is easy, my yoke is light, and we go, I don't know, Jesus, seems pretty hard. Or he says, hey, in me, you can have life and life more abundantly. And we go, but I don't feel like I'm living an abundant life. I don't feel like your yoke is easy. Maybe it's because we're still trying to control. We're still holding on to our power. And Jesus says, if you want to find your life, you must lose it. You got to take up the cross. And the beautiful thing about the story of Jesus is that we don't serve a God that just looks at us and goes, hey, yeah, this is the way you got to do it. You got to die to yourself. You know, good luck with that. I'll see you on the other side. He actually went to the cross, guys. All the things that crucifixion was, he went through. Brutally tortured and executed. Killed. And he says, that's actually the way to find your life. Now, we can believe that because we are on the other side of resurrection. And Jesus can offer us a life, an abundant life, through the process of death to self, because he goes, I conquered it. Because I resurrected. Had he not, we wouldn't be here today. I guarantee you that. But he's resurrected. He's resurrected. And we can put our trust in him. Death to self. This isn't easy. I am under no, like, there's no mistake. This is hard. It's a decision we make every day. Will I choose my own power? Will I trust Jesus's kingdom, which means I got to release it? I got to let go. Actually, I got to die. That's not easy. And I don't talk about this lightly, because for some of you in this room, it means dying to ideas, thoughts, passions, desires, wants, dreams, hopes. Some of you got to pick up your cross so that you can actually become more like the person God created you to be, so you can become more human, and so you can actually find life. And that just requires trust, guys. Like, you just gotta trust. Doesn't make sense. The powers of the world, they didn't make, Pilate's like, don't you understand I have power to crucify you or to free you? Did the religious leaders like, hey, we have a law that says you gotta do that? It's like, yeah, I just gotta trust. So the question we have, that we wrestle with this Easter season, what do you need to take up your cross and follow Jesus with? He said, to be my disciple, apprentice, follower, you actually have to die so he can live in you. What does that look like in your work, your family, your community? What does it look like for you to take up your cross? What does it look like at home when you're trying to fight for your own power with your spouse or your kids? And you just needed to go, no, I'm going to die to self right now. What does it look like at work when your boss is asking you to do a million things that you don't feel like you should have to do and want to do? What does it look like to take up your cross and just go, no, I'm going to die to myself right now? Because somehow Jesus said this is the actual way to find life. I'm going to try trusting it. What about in your community? Well, I'm too tired. I got so much going on. I don't want to do this. What does it mean to die to yourself so that he can live through you? We must be people of the cross. As we prepare for communion, we have our leaders, ushers are going to come on up. And if you did not grab communion on your way in, our leaders are here to go ahead and get that to you. Just lift your hand. They'll make sure you get some communion. And as that's being passed out, this is what I want you to wrestle with. I want you to go ahead and consider for yourself what it means to take up your cross and follow Jesus. What does that look like in your life, in your home, in your community? To put your trust in him. As we consider these things, we'll take communion in a minute. Let's wrestle with what God might be saying to us this morning.